Life Audio.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Happy Rant podcast. I want to tell you about our partner, Visual Theology. If you go to visualtheology.church, you can check out the full slate of resources that they offer. Visual Theology is one of the best biblical and theological resourcing sites on the internet. There's digital resources, there's print resources, and as you can tell by the name, they are visually inclined. So the idea is beautiful, well-imagined design to help us understand the Bible and theological concepts better, taking difficult passages of scripture, big theological concepts, and putting them into a visual form, whether that's in a book or on a poster or on a t-shirt, that allows us to better grasp what those mean, along with some really clear written biblical teaching. So if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, if you're in ministry, especially youth ministry, college ministry, if you're a small group leader, or if you just want to understand the Bible and theology better, visit visualtheology.church and use the code HAPPYRANT at checkout for a 20% discount. You will be astounded at the quality of the design as well as the clarity of the teaching. It is an incredibly helpful collection of resources. So again, visualtheology.church and use the code HAPPYRANT at checkout for a 20% discount. I also want to let you know that we have a Patreon site. For those of you who aren't familiar, Patreon is a site that allows listeners like you to support content creators like us financially. We joke a lot about being big business mavens and how much money we make on this podcast. The answer is we actually don't make very much money on this podcast at all. So the financial support that many of you already give and that we would love more of you to give is really helpful for covering our production costs, for doing spin-off things like our sports show, for doing live events, all of which have a cost attached that would otherwise come out of our pockets. So if you go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/happyrantpodcast, you can check out our site. What you'll find there is a chance to give any amount monthly, could be a dollar, could be $1,000, at different tiers. We will send you free signed books. And then here's the kicker. We do bonus podcast episodes exclusively for our Patreon supporters. We try to do them weekly. It probably comes out to be more like 35, 40 times a year. We've done over 50 of these since we opened our Patreon account. So you have all of that backlog. These are exclusive. We don't release these in the normal feed, except occasionally, exclusive for our Patreon supporters. So again, go to patreon.com/happyrantpodcast. And we would love it if you were able and willing to support us for any amount monthly. Lastly, I want to highlight our sports podcast. Ted and I do a sports podcast. It used to be part of this feed, and for some of you, it was a highlight. For others of you, you were like, skip that mess. Well, it is its own thing now. So you're welcome to those of you who don't like sports. For those of you who do, go to wherever you get podcasts and search Happy Rant Sports. Please subscribe to it. Share it with friends. You'll be familiar with it. We're not analysts, we're not reporters, but we do some analysis. It's a lot of fan interaction. It's what we love about sports. It's how sports interact with life. We talk a lot of nostalgic sports, what we used to love, how we played growing up, how we became fans, those kinds of things. We'd love it if you listened. It's a really good time. Just go search for Happy Rant Sports wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Boys, we have some intriguing questions to discuss, including a writing thing and an academic thing. Very excited to talk about both things. And very excited to be inside.
Listeners are not excited about writing or academics. That's not a solid subject list.
That is true, Pipe. Like, most people aren't excited about those things at all. And in fact, I'm not excited about them sometimes, you know, like, just to be crystal clear on it. We'll get into that and much, much more, boys, right after this quick break. All right, we're back. Boys, I love how we're doing basically radio for free now, but we're still doing ad breaks. That seems like, I don't know if that's cool or like some kind of big meta joke or what. But
I consider it naming it and claiming it. We're going to name these breaks and we're going to claim, you know, an outpouring of blessing and it will come. That's my working theory and bad theology.
Folks, this is us pretending to do a radio show that makes money. And part of pretending is putting the ad breaks in. So we will continue doing that. Pipe, you hit the group chat with a very intriguing proposition. You said that you had a professorial slash academic question that would resonate with both Ronald and myself. And I'm kind of dying to get into that, man. What do you got?
All right. So as you both know, I started seminary about a month ago now. And so I'm multiple assignments in, I'm multiple weeks in. And here's what I've realized, and I can't reconcile this. So Ted, my question for you as a professor is, how do you decide how much to assign in light of how much might be assigned by all these other professors? Let me caveat it this way. I have one professor, he's a very nice man, who said, this should be about 15 to 20 minutes of reading per day. Nonsense. B, if I have 20 minutes of reading per day in four or five classes, that's a lot of reading per day. So that's the general question. And then I have a follow-up, but let's just get into that. Like, how do you consider this in light of what else they might have going on in their academic lives?
Yeah, that's really good. And I actually have a follow-up for you on seminary. So we'll get into all these things. But to me, and this is kind of foundational, let's start it out by saying, like Ronald's father, I'm not a big homework guy. I'm not a busy work guy. I mean, if it's not directly tied to some skill that they need to learn, and we're going to take the shortest path possible toward learning it. So I don't do a lot of busy work in my classes. Like, the assignments are pretty direct. I feel like they always know what they're supposed to do, and it shouldn't take them too terribly long to do it. Because I'm a big proponent on students having a life. And part of being a writer, you know, I teach writing, is I want them to have a life and be experiencing things and have time to read for pleasure. And, you know, so I assign reading, but the reading I assign, quite frankly, is it's fun. Like, it's commercial reading, you know, it's not textbook type reading. So it's go, you know, read some pages of this book that sold a whole bunch of copies because it was really, really good. And, you know, I know it's a bit idealistic to think that they don't hate the homework in my classes slash want to do it, but I think that's mostly the case. And I just try not to exasperate them with it, you know, because I know they will have profs, especially in these core classes, that just load them up with kind of an ungodly amount of homework. Does that make sense?
It does. And I would venture to say, I think you're the exception, not the rule, when it comes to choosing how to assign. I'd be curious to hear, you know, Ronnie's experience of this going through. What are you on now? Like, your fourth postgraduate degree?
No, Judas Priest. No.
Almost Dr. Martin.
Yeah. Well, I'm so close yet so far, you know, if you guys get what I'm saying. Yeah, I think, you know, it, what I'm fascinated by, and obviously I'm not a prof like Big T, but I finally had to ask, like, some profs that I felt like wouldn't be offended by the question, like, basically, like, this thing of, like, dude, like, how is it just up to you to decide these things, or is there, like, is there some standardized way of making these, of, like, assigning,
are there rules,
work? Because yeah, because, you know, it's so fun. And I finally had guys say, oh, no, it's literally, like, it's literally just up to me.
Yeah.
And I said, well, here's the thing. Like, I think that you are reasonable in what you assign, and you're not so about, like, stacking the work as you are us actually grappling with and then grasping the thing that we're trying to learn and you're trying to teach us. Mm-hmm. And I said, and because the way I learn is I don't like reading four books a day, and I don't like sitting behind my laptop. So to me, the best teachers were the ones that gave me space to actually think about the thing they were trying to teach and not overload me the other way. And then you have the other people that are like, it doesn't, all they seem to feel like they want, all it feels like they seem to want you to do is be able to check the box of the actual work. Yeah. And so it's just so baffling to me, because it's like that you have a great experience with some of these guys, some of these women as well. And like in others, you don't, because it's like, do you guys, like, do you understand there's more to it than just like the part of, like, writing and reading? There's like more to it than that. And I don't know. I'm still baffled by the whole process, to be quite honest.
Yeah. So here's part of the problem. That's really good. And I'm baffled by it too. So even though I'm in the business, I'll just add that I'm also very baffled by it. And I think, like, the problem is there's no way to measure if you're a good professor or not, right? So a lot of professors, especially the insecure ones, will kind of make this logical leap where they go, if my syllabus is really big and it looks like I'm assigning a whole lot of work, then the administration will think that I'm good at my job, right? And they can talk about pedagogy. They can show you the 900 assignments that they posted on, you know, Canvas or whatever online, you know, garbage thing that you're using that's supposed to make your life easier but doesn't. And there's a certain kind of prof that gets really excited about that process. And then there's profs like me and probably you, baby, if you ever get into it, who don't get excited about that. We get excited about, like, sharing genuine magic with my students.
Yeah, you want, like you want, like, you want that interaction. That's kind of why you show up in the morning.
That's it. I want the interaction. I want to share something with them genuinely that's awesome, right? Like, read this thing. This is amazing. Like, this is a great example of what we're trying to learn, so give it a read.
And the pinnacle of that is when they all... The pinnacle of that is when they all stand on their desks and shout, "Oh, captain, my captain." Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And get mad at their dads.
I'm just wanting to make sure I was tracking with you.
Well, Big T, I got a question for you, T. Given that you're on the other side of this. So, okay, that makes something you just said makes sense to me. And I always wondered this. So when you create a syllabus, and man, I'm telling you, this this show is already super compelling, guys.
Oh, it's scintillating.
But when we start using words like syllabus, we might as well just stop recording.
Throw in rubric and we'll lose everyone. It'll be great.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly. But since we're on it, and since we've already lost literally every listener and sponsor at this point anyway.
We don't have any sponsors.
Yeah, it doesn't matter anyway. Yeah. But when you create a syllabus, I never thought about the fact that does it have to go before a board for them to approve, or do you just have carte blanche with that? Can you just make it whatever you want?
Okay, so here's the funny thing. The syllabus is the single dumbest thing in academia, which is saying a lot because there's so many dumb things.
Is it just perfunctory? It's something you have to have?
Yes, it's perfunctory. You email it to, like, the higher-ups. It goes in a file. Nobody ever looks at it. You know, I use it to convey a couple of things, but, like, I go through it on the first day of class. And then I'm basically like, don't be the kid who slavishly checks the syllabus, because I'm going to change a whole bunch of stuff, right? Like, we're going to spend more time on some things and less time on other things. And
so the syllabus is for you, is for your it's for your bosses. That's
Definitely. I mean, it's not a useful document at all. It's not readable. It's not meant to be readable. It's a huge pain. And, you know, much like the homework thing, I try to make mine as direct and clear and kind of uncluttered as possible, but that's kind of hard to do with a document where you have to include a bunch of language. Like, so the higher ups will send a whole bunch of language on certain things that we have to include in there and blah, blah, blah. We're getting deep into the weeds of it, but suffice it to say, I don't have a high view of the syllabus. Because again, it's another one of these academic documents for which there's no real world, like, analog to it. You know what I mean? You don't get a syllabus. You don't, like, go to the syllabus section at Barnes & Noble and, like, buy one, you know? nobody's flipping through syllabi on the beach or on the subway or whatever. So.
I mean, there are those dudes, and I mean, are you... I don't know if you're pumped that I use the word perfunctory or not, baby, but I just wanted to ask.
I am pumped. I like the word perfunctory because it applies to so many things in the academy. Like,
I feel like maybe that's the only word I've taken from my 9 degrees, is I learned a word that's called perfunctory.
Things that you do for no reason. Right. And okay.
I try to use it every sermon I preach too, just to say, guys, you know, it's a perfunctory thing for us.
That's good. Yeah, you should work it in. You know, you gotta make good on these degrees now. I mean, you've spent $1.2 million getting them. And
all right, I could have not gotten the degree and just retired super early, but I just went ahead and got a degree.
Yeah, I mean, who wants that? That sounds terrible.
It sounds horrible. I'd rather just be doing degrees.
Exactly. Doing degrees. Piper, now, I have a question for you vis-a-vis seminary.
All right.
Because we kind of know now, since Ronald's been in seminary for 9 years, we know...
The entire life of this program, he's been in seminary, yeah.
Dude, I haven't, man. It makes me so mad to hear you say that, too. But, okay, go on. It's not your fault. It's my fault, but I'm just saying.
Baby, you're being a bad vibes guy now. Don't do it. We know Ronald's seminary persona, and it's complain about seminary all the time and books and reading, but also talk about it all the time. And I feel like almost every seminarian has a persona. My question to you, Pipe, is what is yours?
TBD.
Or is it unclear yet? Okay, yeah. Talk about that.
We're in the formative stages. So the seminary that I'm part of is almost entirely remote. So it's not like there's not a lot of people in Tweed walking around on a nice Baptist campus somewhere. So I don't mm-hmm. get to sort of play off of that either for or against or in rebellion. So it's all online except for a couple 3-day intensives per semester. Uh-huh. So, and I have
which
my first
AKA all seminaries now.
Okay.
Is it
okay.
Really, baby?
You would know because you've seen the transition from like the Stone Ages to today because you've been in seminary that whole time. I, on the other hand, am new to this. So I have my first one next week and I'll have a much better idea of how it all works then. What I've discovered is that what I anticipated my persona being is likely not to be the case because when I hear that. Seminary, I think youngish, aspiring theologians who annoy the fire out of me. And if I'm in school with those guys, I'm just going to be mad all the time. Just disliking all of them. This is all going to be a grind. What I discovered is most of the people, and maybe this is all seminary now too, most of the people who I will be entering school with are all like dads and ranging from late 20s to like mid 50s. So I kind of sit right in the middle there. And so it's like, oh, these are all normal people doing ministry work. Some of them are like master electricians. There's an HVAC tech there, but they're all kind of heavily invested in their churches, all of which actually tilted my perspective a lot towards, I might actually like these people instead of I have to go to school with a bunch of 25-year-old aspiring NT Wrights. That sounds awful. So there was a whole category of vibe that I think is just off the table for me because I think I might actually like the people I go to school with, which is...
Pipe, I think you're going to dig it, man.
I mean, all of that is promising.
I know some people that have gone to Grimke, and when they go do sort of like the live with in Tweed sessions, I like to call them, and they always say it's super fun. And it is. It's like for dudes that are older that are already in full-time ministry, so you're not like... You're like all the arrogance has been sort of like strained out of them by that point. And probably all the, you know, just, you know, any sense of life and energy and, you know, all of that, you know, ministry's probably strained that out of them, you know, so they're a little more realistic and they're looking to really just kind of hang out, you know, and try to make it an enjoyable thing more than anything else. And I think that's how it's been for my doctoral stuff. It's like, it's all older dudes. I'm not even the oldest dude in these things, which is surprising at this stage of life. And
keep that other guy alive.
Well, dude, I mean, seriously. And when you get like it's a weird camaraderie. Like, so in my classes, it took me a minute, but I found this one dude that is as miserable as I am doing it. And that dude, that is hard to find. And I found this one dude that's like, dude, I'd literally rather be doing anything right now. And it was like this big shining like star like shined over him when I heard him say that. And we just kind of like text back and forth now. And it's fun because we kind of found kindred spirits. So
I have a question about that, though. And then I have a broader grad school question for both of you. My question about that is, like, nobody has a gun to your guys' head saying, go get a doctorate. Like, if it's so terrible, like, why are you doing it?
Well,
you know,
I think,
what I mean?
I mean, yeah, I know.
Some cost.
It's more time than we got, but like it was one of those things where, you know, I needed a couple of doors to open for me to get into the program. Mm-hmm. Those doors opened. We thought, let's do it, right? So let's just jump in. Mm-hmm. And then for me, we've talked about this. Like I wouldn't mind maybe like doing some teaching on that at that level. Yeah. And so for that level, you got to have this degree, and it's like, all right. So it's like, you know, I don't know. It was one of those things where you just, in the moment, you're like, it's an opportunity. You dive through it, and then it ends up being, it ends up being a, not maybe not different than you thought, but like mm-hmm. it ends up coming at a time in life that's been incredibly like inconvenient, and it's made a lot of other things yeah. overwhelming. And dude, it's the whole deal, right?
Yeah, but, yeah. I get
boring,
it,
but it's boring.
Yeah, no, I get it. I totally get it. Boys, let's take a break for some more fake ads that won't pay us money, and then we'll come back, and I got another grad school question. All right, we're back. Here's my question. Pipe, you're getting a doctorate, correct?
No, master's.
Really? Okay, so this is fascinating to me.
I just pretended to be a master of things prior. Now I actually have to earn the title.
My question was going to be, I don't feel like anybody gets a master's anymore. I feel like these places are just, they're peddling doctorates. And it's like everybody's getting a doctorate now. But I like that you're kind of going the other way and getting a master's.
Yeah, big pivot, big plot twist, everybody.
Big plot twist, huge. You know,
the big thing now, T, is that so a lot of dudes aren't getting MDivs anymore. They're getting MAs now, right? So that's
really
been a big pivot. Yeah.
Now, what would your MA be in? What would the field of study be?
I don't know. What's yours, Pi? Is it just like a Master of Theological
Studies? Yeah, Master of Theological Studies. So it's kind of a general theology degree. You can like do an emphasis with it that's more ministerial. So preaching or, you know, those, the urban ministry, et cetera. But it's just a baseline Master's of Theological Studies.
Gosh, guys, I got another scintillating question. Are you ready for it?
I've never had this much fun in my life on a podcast. I can imagine the level of fun everybody's having right now. It's off the
chart. It's so electric.
I've already decided on the title for this episode, and it's Misery Loves Company Academic Edition. So
I love it. So my question is, how does the MA differ from the MDiv? Like, is there a tangible difference? Or
yeah,
is it just
MDiv
semantics?
The MDiv is you learn Hebrew and Greek, and the MA doesn't require Hebrew and Greek. That's it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah.
Also, I think the MDiv is like 80 more credits. I mean, people go to school for like 11 years to get an MDiv.
It is more credits. That's true too. You're right, Pipe. That's true too.
It's an aggressive degree. All right, Ted, I have another question for you. We can get to the writing stuff in a minute, because that will be far more interesting for listeners, I'm sure. But this is me just lancing some academic boils.
Yeah.
So you don't assign things this way, but you work in an environment where it is the norm. And it is when, you know, professors are like, well, you're going to read this entire systematic theology textbook by Christmas. And then, you know, four professors do something similar. And so there's just this reality of like, I have to churn through this work, and I can either learn stuff or I can get the work done, but I can't do both. I'm not even sure what the question is, other than what the heck? Like, why is this the educational theory that like reading 1,000 pages in like cursory fashion, perusal, is more beneficial than something that actually is like invested and focused, and maybe I'll glean something from it?
Well, there again, you're dealing, Pipe, with, it's just a syllabus flex. You know what I mean? It's like academics, like professors have so little, you know what I mean? They have actually so little to be proud of. Like, that's something they can hang their hats on. And it makes them feel like they're creating, quote, a rigorous like learning environment or whatever. But to me, and you tell me if you're doing this already, but if not, I want to empower you to do it. Like, and I think people who tend to be rule followers have trouble with this. But I would like to empower
you. So you're not really wondering if I'm doing this, because you know exactly where I fall on the rule follower scale.
Exactly. Yeah, I would hope that you're picking through it and you're going, that has value for me. That's completely worthless. And you're zeroing in on the things that have value, because at the end of the day, look, they're not going to fail you. Like, nobody gets failed anymore. You know what I mean? You can't fail anybody, because you're a paying customer, you know, and they can't make the customer mad. So all the kind of academic rigor stuff is just sort of window dressing. And if you're doing your level best, and you're like learning what you can from it, and learning and gleaning things that are meaningful or life-giving or going to help you in ministry or whatever, like I would sort of empower you to disregard the rest. And it's like, it's the kind of academic triage that even young people have to do, like undergrads, you know, and Tristan's taking, I don't know, 15 hours this semester and he's making the same choices, right? Like you can't do everything at a high level. So you have to kind of decide what you're going to do at a low level, what you're not going to do at all, and then what you really want to do at a high level. Yeah. That would be my advice.
I mean, boys, I have some stuff I want to discuss off the air in regards to that.
But, oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so intriguing and so much so that it feels like perhaps what you have to discuss off the air might be more interesting than any.
Oh, it's so much
thing.
More. It's incredibly more interesting. And again, I could.
It wouldn't take much.
I mean, I could literally say anything after this podcast and it would be more interesting than what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah.
For sure. Pipe or Ron, anything else on academics before we pivot into writing?
Only that I want to make a commitment to our listeners that we will never
we'll never do this again. Yeah. Well, I'm guessing, and I would like to hear you guys try to put a percentage on this. What percentage of our listeners are seminary nerds? I've got to think it's 45, 50, maybe a good half. You know,
yeah, I think there's a good percentage. Yeah, it's hard to put a number on it, but I would imagine pretty high.
Or like seminary wives, you know, your husband goes to seminary and you're kind of left to like, you know,
pay all the bills
yourself for 5 years and pay all the bills and like be the sole breadwinner and all the other things that, you know, those ladies have to deal with.
Yeah, so. That's a great gig, right?
Yeah, what an awesome gig. Yeah.
Oh, dude, I mean, can you imagine anything more enjoyable?
No, in fact, I'm going to encourage KK to go to seminary so I can get a little taste of it.
There are a couple seminaries that historically have done like seminary wives programs where they it's basically like home ec and pastor's wives training, and it's almost like etiquette classes and all sorts.
Dude,
it's a real thing.
That sounds awesome,
dude. I love how your husband goes to seminary and then like now they're making you suffer even more.
Yeah, they're like, and you need to have a bouffant and have a nice tea service.
And and you're like, wow, he's going to come back even more insufferable, right? His sermons and his even his anecdotes are going to be more long and boring. I can't wait.
Oh, man.
Oh, good grief. Boys, let's talk about a slightly lighter topic, and that is how we get out of slumps as writers. We're familiar with slumps in baseball pipe and hitting and various athletic slumps, but as far as getting in a writing slump, I don't know if this is like... you can't write anything or everything you write is bad. I don't know really the spirit behind the question. Do you have any more clarity on that, Pipe?
I don't. I just saw it sort of pinging around amongst, you know, friends of mine who are writers of various like online writers, published authors, etc. And there was a lady who posed this question online, and the responses were coming in, you know, all sorts of practical advice. And it was, but yeah, just how do you, what are your practices or habits to get out of writing slumps? And that was the entirety of it. So I think we get to interpret it however we want.
Interesting. Do you have any that like spring to mind for you?
Well, I do not approach writing romantically at all in terms of like needing ideal conditions. It's always kind of just doing the work, and I like it. But it's not, and so that means that the writing slump thing, I don't know what a writing slump is in the same term that like a novelist might feel where they're like, I'm just stuck in this story. I don't know my way forward. I'm just like, I got to turn the assignment in, whether it's a book or a paper or whatever. So I don't have any that are like, man, when I'm just locked up and I've got nothing, but I don't write for a living either. So very rarely am I just like staring at a blank screen going, I have nothing and my deadline is in 6 hours, which,
yeah,
I mean, that used to happen when I did more columns and stuff. But so, yeah, for me, it has more to do with just the discipline and the habit of like, you just sit down and do it. Like writing slumps kind of don't matter. You just kind of have to work through them.
Yeah, our editors definitely don't care if we feel like we're in a slump. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like movie writers always have. Yeah, movie writers have great solutions to this. They like do mescaline or like go rent a cabin on the ocean or whatever. And like no one I know actually does any of those things. But baby, what about you? You got any great slump busters?
Dude, you know what? It's funny. It's a little more like pipe, I think, especially if you're just writing, you know, kind of Christian content, you know, mm-hmm. you know, Christian living content, where it's like, mm-hmm. I think my slump is when I'm so bored with what I'm writing. I'm just like, I'm just not doing it. I'm not getting anything done, you know? And it's like, cause I just don't feel like writing. So I just have a hard, I have a real hard, like, if I literally don't feel like it and I just keep typing the same, you know, sentence, you know, because I'm bored and I'm looking at other things, I just yeah. walk away. I just won't write. So unless yeah. I'm like feeling that flow and I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm into it and my mind's, you know, it's kind of all, it's firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. I'm like, man, it'll be better tomorrow. And
yeah.
hopefully it's not, dude, you get up to that thing where it's due tomorrow. And I mean, gosh, if you're at that point and you don't have at least the majority of the content in place, and then I'll do stuff like where I'll just end something. I did this on this last book I just finished where there was a couple of chapters where they needed to be longer and I didn't really finish my thought, but I just stopped and I just turned it in. And it's like, just see what they said, because it's like, whatever. I mean, it's nobody else is going to know that I just stopped, because you got to stop yeah. somewhere. Yeah. And the editors were like, oh, we like the way you ended that one. Like, okay, we're yeah. good. Yeah.
yeah.
So I don't know. I just don't really stress about it, I think, is the big thing for me. It's not a huge stress. But if you're working on something, I think if you're working on something more like creativity oriented, right? Mm-hmm. Like if it, like what Pipe said, if it's more like more story based,
yeah.
something you're making up. If you're making up something, like, you can legitimately hit like a, you know, creative block, I think, because you
yeah,
just,
that is true.
There's no rules, right? You're just making it up. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. What about you, T?
Yeah, I think mine's similar to yours. Like, I enjoy feeling it when I'm writing.
Yeah.
And if I don't feel it, I'll do something else, even for like a half hour or an hour or whatever. I'll just do some administrative or grade some papers or do something else that I have to do so that my mind is more clear.
Yeah, for sure.
For the thing that I want to do. So, you know, that's kind of operative for me. You know, I feel like people are always looking for like, oh, I take a walk or I exercise or, you know, and there's no magical way to have something insightful to say and know exactly how to say it other than
yeah.
just trying it, you know, trying it out. So to Pipe's point, like, and I think we're all at a place in our careers where the romance is largely gone. So it's like, I'm either doing this or not doing it, and I want to be done, so I should just do it, and I should just work my way through it and try some stuff, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. Sometimes I'll read it out loud to my wife. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'll have her read it, and I'll like look over her shoulder at her reactions while she's reading it. Mm-hmm. And in addition to being kind of fun, that often like shows me whether or not a thing is working. And you know, so that's fun. And I mean, look, like there's very little about being a writer that's like lucrative or actually satisfying. So like if you can entertain your wife with something that you've written, like it's worth
probably the most success you're gonna have.
That's about the most success or the most joy that we're gonna have in this. So we might as well take it while we can.
Boy, this is feeling like talking about academia now, isn't it, boy?
Yeah, it kind of is, dude. And it's okay. So here's an overarching question that we can end with. And this is a stage of life thing, I think, for all of us. And it's definitely coming out in the program. I think there are people who really, really feel romantic about academia and who really, really feel romantic about writing. And we aren't those people. And my question is, why not? Like, we're three very different people. And I know, baby, for you and me, like, you and I have the gear to, like, feel romantic about stuff. Like, we can get romantic about all kinds of things. And, like, Pipe and I get romantic about baseball and sports. And, like, I know he has that gear, too. But the three of us can't get romantic about the academy. Nor can we get romantic, really, about writing. And I'm just curious as to why you guys think that is. I'm interested. Pipe, do you have thoughts?
I mean, I think some of it is just being romantic about something feels like a luxury to me. It feels like it's something one can only do when one has very little else to do.
That's true.
And
yeah,
so
that's a good point.
I don't know. I feel like I could probably be much more sort of caught up in the inspiration and creativity and romanticism of writing if I had time to do something other than this is my 2-hour window. I've got to hammer stuff out. And so there's just life sort of, it's not like it's ground the enjoyment out of things for me. It's just changed the, like, I am not doing this to, like, give me warm and fuzzies. I'm doing it for another purpose. And how I decided to do it in the first place was gauged on something else too. Like, people who get into being a writer for romantic reasons will probably have that ground out of them.
Yeah.
Maybe they can maintain some of it, but yeah, I think for me, it just, romanticism feels like a luxury, you know, like my wife several months ago was watching, Anne of Green Gables and there's just sort of like a walking through fields pace of life where everything is wondrous and beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, if I ever had time to do what she's doing, I might feel somewhat similar, but my
also,
life.
So Anne is a child, you know?
Yeah, there's that too. No
romanticization is a, yeah, it's a child's thing, you know? And I think in a positive way, it's a child's thing, right? Like we romanticized everything when we were kids. Like, we were all going to play in the NFL or, like, go to the moon or, you know, change the world or whatever. But, like, it is kind of a child's thing. And I would say I got into writing largely for romantic notions. And I was able to maintain it for, like, a decade, which I think is pretty good. But then, yeah, like, around age 30, you become an adult. You've got some kids. Like, it's harder to sort of indulge yourself in that way, I guess. Baby, your thoughts on why we're not romantic about the Academy or writing?
Well, look, I think, so you said it earlier, Big T, like, so I have my romantic phases for things that I do on a creative level. So they're still there. They're still intact. So my favorite part of doing anything is like dreaming about doing it, about what it's going to be, what it's going to look like, what it's going to sound like. And I love that. That's my favorite part. So my favorite two parts are dreaming about what it's going to be, and then after the end of it, looking back on what it became. The middle part, the actual doing of it, is just, it's hard to be romantic about that because it's blood, sweat, and tears at the end of the day, right? You're just putting in the hours. You got to make the thing, right?
Yes.
But I love dreaming about the possibility of something. And I love that part of it. I always have. That hasn't changed for me. I still do it. It's the reason why I even do it. I mean, you could argue the reason why anybody does anything is because it started off with you being romantic about it, having the desire to do it, envisioning what it could be. I just love that part of it so much. I love that part of it too much, I think. Yeah. And I can get a little miserable in the execution part in the middle of it when it's like, okay, look, this is all, the dream phase is over. I'm not yet to the completion phase. And now I'm just like swimming in a pool of misery because all the romance is gone now. But I love that beginning part so much that that's why I keep doing the things I do, because I'm living off of that initial romance. I love it.
Yeah, I used to love it. And I think I would enjoy loving it again. I used to love that beginning part. I was like you in that.
Baby, it can come back. It can return.
I hope so.
Return, you know, to,
and it's
splendor.
Not like I'm miserable in it now, but like, yeah, there's just a, when you've been around so long, like you know how good a thing is going to do. You know what I mean? And like, you know, your record isn't going to ship 1.5 million units. Like you just know. And so you can't like drive around and dream about being the guy who shipped that many units. You know what I mean?
I think and that's a great point, by the way.
Yeah.
But I think what shifted for me is the, I think in earlier days, it was, how is it going to do? And now it's just more about the fact that I got to create something that I like in that, whatever. Yeah. If it's 10 people or 10,000 people, like, somebody's going to enjoy it for sure.
Yeah.
And that's not what I'm basing it on. I just love the fact that I was able to create something new. And I don't know, getting over the fact that, it's not, you know, it's not going to buy me that second house.
Yeah. Know? No, I know. And it's actually good to get to that place where you're realistic about stuff. I mean, I think to a large degree, the movie And like trying to do the movie has ruined me on this stuff for a while. You know, that's just been such a tremendous mountain to get over. And there's been so much like disunity and disagreement within our team. It's just quite frankly been miserable for a few years. Like the fun romantic part, which was really fun and romantic, like that really, it delivered and it hit at a high level. I would say from the screenwriting phase all the way through production and even a little bit after production, like there were real romantic vibes around it. But then, yeah, the reality of, okay, everybody disagrees. Like, how do we actually do this and get it done in a way that, you know, the four of us can live with?
Yeah, that industry is just a different animal, isn't it? I mean, things can get stuck.
Oh yeah,
pre post production for like decades, right?
Dude, it's totally, like, it's miserable. Yeah. You know, it's miserable, and you're kind of in and out of fellowship with various people at different times, and it's like there's a part of me that's like, I wish I'd never tried to do this because this was the big dream, right? It was the big swing, and I don't know. I look backward on it sometimes, and I think, wow, like truly smart people don't try to do this. You know, like it's only idiots like myself who would take a swing at something like this. But hopefully we can finish that. I can get it out of my system, and then I can get back to like enjoying dreaming about stuff.
That last sentence is only accurate if you define smart by risk averse, which,
yeah,
I mean, almost every significant like launch of anything, it involves some amount of risk, whether it's emotional risk or financial risk or whatever. So like, I don't know that that's the definition of smart. I would also say, Ted, you said something earlier in the podcast that sort of cracks the window into like, you still have some of this sort of romanticism in your life, because you talked about, you love teaching because you love going into the classroom and seeing like magic happen for the students. Yeah. That's a romantic notion of the best sort, you know, where there's sort of this intangible motivating, like, oh, that's beautiful what just happened there. And it's not like, you don't check the box on that. You're not like, accomplished my thing for the day. It was like, man, that was this sort of intangibly wonderful experience.
Dude, right. Like, you know it when you see it. And I think as students, I would hope, and I don't know because I've never been to seminary, but I did go to grad school, you know, a decade and a half ago. Like, I would hope that there are some magical moments on the student side left for you guys where you come away from a piece of reading or come away from a lecture or a discussion in a class and go like, wow, like that was really insightful, or it was fun, it was enlivening. You know, I would hope that's still on the table for you guys.
I think it is. You know, it's funny because people have asked me this, and I've like in this doctorate thing, I've actually learned a lot, and it's actually helped me at a local church level in probably three or four like major categories. That's no exaggeration. And it's been really good. I think what bothers me so much about it is it's not what we've learned. It's the way that we have to go about learning it. And like, that's just a big feature for me. Right.
Yeah.
It's like, I just think there's a better way to do this. Not because I know what the better way is. I'm not like one of those guys, but I just think like, it shouldn't be this sloggy, and I know it's supposed to be hard.
Yeah,
I know it's supposed to be hard, but like, there should be some element of like, gosh, this it has a way of reaching into what you are able to excel at and enhance that. Yeah. And it's just like, dude, it just hasn't done that. And it's like, everything can't be a slog, and yet like everything's been a slog, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's a failure. You know, I do. I think it's a failure because as a teacher, I don't think any teacher at the beginning of their career goes into it going, I hope my students really feel as though this is a slog. You know what I mean? Like I would even go so far as to say with, you know, with stuff like ministry and the Bible, and definitely for writing with me, like as a teacher, it really needs to be joyful. Like writing is fun. It's why I became a writer. Like I enjoy doing it, and I want my students to enjoy doing it. And I want the process of the classroom side and all the practice that we do to be basically joyful. And I always tell them like, look, you're not going to enjoy all these assignments, you know, you'll enjoy some of them. And I enjoy some of them and I don't enjoy some of them. And, you know, that's just being human. But like, I think writing should be pretty deeply joyful. And if my students were to come away from a class going, yeah, that was a slog, I'd be bummed. You know, I would be genuinely bummed, and I would try to change something. You know 100%. What I mean?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's such a great, point where even, it's almost like, I mean, T, here's the question for you. I mean, is it hard not to get sort of entrenched in the system that they place you in? So you could be somebody with good intentions and say, man, it's not about the amount of work. I just want everybody to be challenged, but I want them to have a good time. But man, what I'm faced with, like I'm faced with certain realities that it's going to be really hard to make it that way. Is that true? Is that?
Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I think it's less true than we think it is, because at the end of the day, we are alone in our classrooms and we're alone to craft a syllabus or build a class. And at the end of the day, we're also just in customer service. And as long as like the seats are full and people are happy, the administrators are happy, you know, right. And there's lots of talk and like rhetoric that would seem to be at odds with what I just said. But at the end of the day, that's the true thing. But I think where it gets sloggy in the academy on the teacher side is to make the model work. And by the model, I mean seminary in your case, or a small Christian college in my case. To make the business model work, every one person that's good at their jobs ends up doing like 2.5 to 3 jobs.
Right.
And it's administration, it's committee work, it's, you know, meeting with people and having coffee with that guy or this guy or whatever. And at the end of the day, all of the ways that they nickel and dime you make you bad at the thing that they hired you to be good at. And I think that's probably operative for a lot of professors and maybe even seminary professors, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So you gotta, I think on the faculty side, you gotta really guard against that. And you've gotta say, so for me, and I am using the word rubric here, so now all of our audience members have left.
Yes. But
like, oh, they're already gone. They have, if they've made it this far.
Academic bingo complete.
Academic bingo. I've got rubric, you know? No, I've developed kind of a rubric for like what I say yes to. And it's actually helped me to say no, because I'm a person who's terrible at saying no, because I really desperately need to be liked. And the need to be liked is at odds with saying no. But like for me, the rubric is kind of at the top, will it lead to more discipleship? Will it lead to like true discipleship? If so, then I'm saying yes. You know, next might be, will it move my program forward or our department forward? And if the answer is yes, I'm probably saying yes to it. You know, and a level below that is it something that I enjoy? Like, will this thing bring me joy? And then I'll say yes to that. But beneath that, there's a whole lot of other things that you get asked to do that don't check any of those boxes. And it's become easier to say no to those things.
Yeah.
So that's been helpful. And that helps me be better at teaching, because I'm not burned out.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, I am burned out. But
yeah, we
theoretically, I'm not burned out.
Yeah, you know? Theoretically. Like in a perfect world where you don't have to like teach, go to school, pay your bills, or really do anything that requires a lack of fun, you're the greatest, most happy, fulfilled guy that ever lived.
Exactly. Take away all the money. That old joke, dude. That's like a decade.
No, that's a great one, man. We haven't used that in a while, baby. We got to bring that out. We got to get out of the dust.
Yeah, we do. Boys, we should end this program.
Love that. I would love all of you.
It's been interesting, boring is how I would say it, which is a lot like most of our classes, I bet.
I think most people listen to this podcast because it's like sitting at a table with guys having a conversation that they're not really having, but it would be interesting if they were part of. This is sitting at a table with guys wishing you could leave the table because that conversation's not interesting.
They're like, oh my gosh, I'm glad I'm not at that table.
When are they going to pay the check and leave? This dinner is going forever.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like we should offer like, hey, for everybody that made it this far in the program, we will send you something signed and autographed.
Yeah. Not money. We'll send you something. Yeah. We'll send you something. Boys, we've done what we always do on this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout a little academia, a little writing, a little complaining. It's been interesting, boring, and until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Our world can feel chaotic and uncertain, but we don't have to live enslaved to fear. Christ has promised me and you his peace, and throughout Scripture has provided powerful tools and practical steps to help us experience greater freedom. I'm Jennifer Slattery, lead host of the Faith Over Fear podcast, inviting you to join me and my team as together we learn how to starve our fears and feed our faith. Subscribe at lifeaudio.com or wherever you access podcast content.